This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, we're going to be talking with Mark Wyatt. Now, Mark is a new author, and he has just written a book called Wyatt's Weird World. And this is only the second interview he has done, so he's a little not quite so fine-tuned as some of my other guests, but he has some interesting stories to tell, and the book is just that. It's some of his paranormal stories from throughout his life, and they're presented sort of as is. So, we're going to be talking with Mark for the next hour and letting him tell you some of his stories. And remember, if you want some extra content, you can become a patron of Where Did the Road Go. It's only $3 a month. And go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. We also have forums up. Everyone wanted forums up, so I put some forums up, and we've had just a little bit of activity in them. We also have a group now on Facebook for Where Did the Road Go. So, please come, participate, tell us your thoughts. We like to hear from you. Seriously, we do. All right, here's tonight's show. I'm talking with Mark Wyatt, and where are you based out of, Mark?
I'm in Cornwall, in the UK, in the far west. The little spindly piece of granite stuck at the end. Underneath Wales.
Okay,
between,
all right.
Between Wales and Brittany.
And you have a website called Wyatt's Weird World.
I do.
And you just put out a book of some of your own experiences.
Yes.
And how long did it take you to write this?
Well, to be honest, it was fairly quick. On your PDF copies, that may well have shown as well, because it wasn't quite the finished article. but basically, all of that was in my head from the past anyway, so it wasn't like I had to, dream any of it up or... It was just there. It was almost a form of, dare I say, it was almost a form of therapy just to actually get it written down, sort of put behind me so I could move on to the next subject. So it was just nice to get it down and rather than just keep it in my head.
If that makes sense. All right. And what is the name of the book?
Right, it is Wyatt's Weird World, a creepy compendium of paranormal, I can't remember the last word, actually. Should have it in front of me. It is really just a collection in the chronological order, or as near as possible, from very early age to quite recent years, actually, very recent.
Okay, and this is available on Amazon.
It is, yeah, Amazon Kindle, yeah.
Okay. How did you get interested in this stuff?
Started really when I was a lad. I won't go into big detail on this, but my father had just the one, probably just the one real experience of his own, and he told me this story when I was probably 6 or 7, and probably in all the time, he died 2 or 3 years ago, and in all that time, he only ever told the story maybe 2 or 3 times. It was usually told by my mother because he didn't like to remember it because it creeped him out so much. And his story was of he was cycling home in the early hours. He was an engine driver in sort of, this was 1960. We lived out in the sticks, out in the rural backwoods, really. Near a city called Guildford, or it is a city technically, but it's just a town, really, quite a small place. And he was cycling home a 5-mile trip in the wilds, and he saw this, what he thought was just a guy on a bicycle up in front of him. and he gradually gained on him. He did in speed, and there was no one else about. It's just very early hours, very dark, very rural, and he saw. He said it was like inwardly lit. You know, it's like it was like an inward glow. It wasn't actually. I think all this sort of came to him later, if you like. He saw it. All he saw to start with was a guy on a bike. What he thought was a guy on a bike. And he, as he gradually got closer, he noticed that it didn't have a light on a proper sort of bicycle lamp. And he basically turned to this guy to tell him, as he passed him, that he had no lights on. And he got the surprise of his life when this fella turned to him and there was no face. It was just like a black void. And to cut a long story short, He disappeared. When he looked again, he was gone, completely gone. There was nowhere he could have gone. And obviously it freaked him out. And within a few days anyway, he saw, I should explain, this was in a tiny village. And there was a gunpowder works within, I suppose, 1,000 yards of where this happened. Which is where I was raised when I was a baby. There were houses. They were slums, actually. They were demolished in 1961. And we lived on that site, on the site of this old gunpowder works. Now, the gunpowder works had had numerous explosions throughout, I think it was about 400-year history. And various, you know, a lot of people were blown to pieces completely unexpectedly, shall we say. So that's where the ghosts come from, I presume. And it's like almost like a triangle. There's the gunpowder works, and then there's a pub called the Percy Arms, which has been there for hundreds of years, which used to be the makeshift morgue for when they did have these accidents at the gunpowder works, which was, you know, a few thousand yards away. So the bits of the bodies from the remains of these explosions were collected and taken to this pub before it was a pub and just laid out waiting sort of Christian burial. So the pub has got quite a record of supernatural activity. And then on the other side of a road, there's a railway station. And between those sort of three places, there's a lot of activity. And obviously my dad experienced some of it. We recently went up there, funnily enough, and probably, I suppose, a month ago, went up there, and my daughter stayed in the pub with her boyfriend. And throughout the early hours, the lights would keep coming on and off, and they had like a sensor lamp in the shower, which sensed when you walked into the shower unit, and it kept coming on and off all night. The television kept coming on and off all night. And she's quite sensitive, I suppose. And she was having a fag outside the pub, sort of about 11 o'clock at night. Well, it's a quiet village, there was nothing about. And she thought she saw a figure walking over by the railway station, which then sort of disappeared behind a car as a car passed it. The fella wasn't there any longer. So I think this whole area is just riddled with it. And those of us who are a little bit sensitive to it do pick up on it.
Now, from reading your book, I would definitely say you have some sensitivities to this stuff.
Yes, I think so. I mean, probably no more than many. I mean, from listening to you on the show, I think you've definitely got that as well.
Sure. But yours seem to be a lot with ghosts, and I don't think I've ever had an actual ghost encounter.
Yeah, I've had various. It's a strange thing, really, because I've seen solid body ghosts. I'm trying to try off the top of my head. I'm thinking, maybe two or three, maybe no more than that. But I recently saw, maybe 2 years ago, I actually saw what I would call like a sort of sketchy ghost. It was, and this is the thing, they're all different for whatever reason, I don't know. The sketchy one was I was driving home. I'd been up the coast to Devon to see my lad plays in a band, and he was at college, in a music college, and cut a long story short, we cut across country, a different route coming home, and it was a very windy night. There'd been terrible winds, and it's very, very rural, you know, sort of going up and down through these valleys full of beautiful trees, mature trees, and there were bits of wood flying everywhere. And we eventually got to this sort of quite high ground sort of village. And as I was driving along, it was well lit as well. It was a well lit village, but no one was about, because by the time we got there, it was, I suppose, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning. And the worst of the wind had died off. But I suddenly noticed this figure come out from the right hand side, from a modern, what we call large lap fence. You know, like the close boarded fence. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it come through the fence. My first sighting of it, and I'm trying to think how far away I was from it. I was probably, let's see, a quarter of one of your football field lengths, probably something, not that far. And I suddenly saw it. This figure, it was like a man. It looked like a man, but it was like a cartoon. It was like an artist had drawn him. So you could sort of see the muscle groups and you could see the movement of him. So if you imagine like a pencil sketch of a man. And it ran very, very fast across the road as if it was, running for its life, I suppose. And the weird thing was, it was such a quick glimpse. It was like a very quick sighting, and it ran across the road. And of course, you've got to remember, I was in a car. I had my daughter was in the front. She didn't see it. I think she was asleep, and my son was in the back, and he didn't see it. And it crossed the road. So it's just a narrow, you know, country road, two lane, and it disappeared into where this cottage was on the left hand side. Well, when I say it was the cottage was butted up to another fence, and it was a modern, it wasn't a proper old school cottage, it was a modern building in an old village. And I couldn't make out from where I saw it whether this figure went through the fence or into the house. So I imagined when I first saw it, because it happened so quickly, I thought, well, there must be a passageway or some sort of gateway. But when I actually arrived at the scene, so to speak, which was, you know, a few seconds later, there was no gate in the fence and there was no door open. So, and there wasn't time for them to get in and close the door. I don't think there was anyway. But there was a light on in the cottage. I call it a cottage. It was more of a modern place, as I say. And it did strike me at the time. I wondered whether whoever was sitting, because the light was on, I wondered whoever was sitting in that house, whether they were, you know, whether they had a sudden cold chill or something as this thing went through, whether they saw it, whether they felt it. But that was a very, very quick sighting. And I think that's the only one I've ever seen which was sketchy. I think the Victorians used to call them shades, didn't they?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, and I think that's probably where that comes from. It's sort of shadowy. But mostly they've been solid, I don't, you know, I'm just another guy that sees these things. But I don't know what the answer is. Obviously, I mean, I only see them. I saw one. I was when I was probably 21, 22. And that's another thing I should point out, that a lot of these things, you watch these ghost hunting shows, which I watch for entertainment only, really, because I don't take probably any of them too seriously. But they're all obsessed with doing it in the dark. And I don't understand that, because most of the ghosts I've ever seen have been in daylight. And I just don't understand this preoccupation with doing everything in the dark. And to give you an example, I was commuting to a college in North Surrey, so it's south of London. I was with two other lads. I was actually walking back from the college to a station called Surbiton Railway Station. And it was busy. It was like Friday night. Everyone was rushing to get home. It's his commuterville. And people were coming out of his station forecourt and people were going to the station. So there was a lot of people about. And I was suddenly, my attention was drawn to this very tall, skinny guy. He reminded me of, if you've ever seen John Cleese in the Ministry of Silly Walks sketch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what he had that look to him. He was sort of very thin, very tall, had a bowler hat on, a suit on. I'm trying to remember now. I think he had a briefcase. But he walked, from what I could see of him, because he was coming through people, he, like a big stride, you know, but he would have a big stride because he was a tall fella. But he seemed to be several inches bigger than everyone around him, taller. And the strange thing was, I've noticed this many times, which makes me think that I believe that these, whatever they are, they are aware of people like myself and others who can see them. And I call them walk-bys. It's like their party piece. It's like they see you and they think, I'm going to do my piece now. And that's how it feels to me, because it's happened so many times to me like that. But anyway, he was walking towards me and I caught his eye, or he caught my eye probably. And I was sort of drawn to him. I just thought, what a strange looking man. And the distance between us was closing all the time. And as I said, I had two mates with me who neither of them saw him. We discussed it later. Neither of them saw him. And he made his way through these commuters as we approached. And as he got closer and closer to me, I mean, he had a very strange, he had a sort of pasty, very pasty faced, sort of white, unnaturally white, like he could do with some sunshine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he had sort of like I can only call it like a sort of maniacal stare, you know. Not in a sort of seriously horror film way, but just, I don't know, just as an odd look to him, like a silly grin. I suppose a silly grin would say better. And it was like he was singling me out. And as he passed by, he got very close, and he sort of peered down at me, because I'm 6 foot. One and a bit, I think. So he was a good 3 inches taller than me. And he had a bowler hat, which made him look even taller. And as he passed by, his appearance had so impressed me that I looked round to watch him go by. And he wasn't there. He just wasn't there. And I just could not figure this out. And, to cut a long story short, I stood there for a while, just staring and trying to work out where he could have gone. And you know, there was a little green area to my left as I'm looking back, and there was a wall and so on, but he couldn't have got through there. I would have seen him if he had. No cars had stopped to pick him up, and I would have seen him walking away because of his height and his bowler hat, because at that time, this was, I suppose, early 80s, you did still see the occasional older man with a bowler hat on. It used to be the thing, I think, in England, in, you know, commuters going to the city of London on the train. They would, some of them would wear a bowler hat and carry a brolly, you know, sort of like Patrick McNee, you know, on the Avengers, that sort of look.
right.
But it was very rare. Even by the 80s, it was very rare. You rarely saw it, which is why, his attention was drawn. But I can only guess at what his story was. But my sort of instinct was that he was coming off a train and going home. But maybe he was, I think I called the story, the jumper, because, as I'm sure you must get everywhere else, you know, in America too, you get these people who jump in front of trains, you know.
Yeah,
and my father, as I said, he was a train driver at one time, and he in later years he worked as a postman, Royal Mail, on the railway stations, and he'd actually seen this, or he'd seen the aftermath, I should say, and this is going back to the 70s. They used to pay them sort of an overtime and a half or whatever to help clear up. which, you know, would make him feel quite ill, but somebody had to do it.
Yeah.
And their term for it, you know, the post office and the railway workers, the reason the post office workers were on the station was because they were unloading the mail trains. Didn't explain that link. So yeah, they used to call them jumpers, you know, which is quite cruel humour, but it's their way of dealing with it, really.
So, and you think this guy might have been a jumper?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I don't know, but that's the feeling I got. I think being so close to the station, he was from where I saw him, I'm almost certain, and he had commuter written all over him. Hmm. You know, it was that's the way he was dressed, the briefcase, the brolly, you know, the bowler hat.
You said he also resembled the grinning man a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't really think that at the time, but that was, you know, that's, to me, the grinning man is similar to, what's the other name? The shadow man, I was in that.
The hat man.
Yeah, sorry, hat man, yeah. Only what I'm trying to say is that knowledge has only come in recent, probably in the last year for me, although I'm sure yourself and many others would have heard of that before. But so at the time I wouldn't have thought that, but looking back at it, and when I was writing it, I'd been listening to various people talking about it, and they described, I can't remember who it was, on one of your shows, where somebody described a guy they'd seen at the side of a road who had this sort of unnatural sort of smile.
Yeah, that was David Weatherly.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
Yes.
And at the time I heard that, I thought, well, that's strange, because that sort of struck a chord with me, because I thought, well, that's similar. Hmm. And I suppose we all give different names to things, you know.
Oh, sure. You also have some experiences where they seem like they're sleep paralysis or out of body experiences, and I wanted you to talk about this—the flying carpet story and the climbing fence or whatever.
Yes, that's. I always feel slightly embarrassed talking about this one, because I feel that people who are really into this stuff may jump to a conclusion, and they may be right. They may be right. Let's face it, they may be right. Whereas I don't shy away from that conclusion. I just feel that there's a deeper. Let me explain.
Tell the story.
I'll tell the story. It's like I used to have these repetitive dreams, recurrent, I should say, when I was a toddler. Well, for many years. I mean, they went on for many, many years, actually carried on until the last one I remember having was in the 90s, and I was in my 30s then. And I think they changed their, the set, if you imagine it like an actor's set or whatever, the set changed as I matured. Mm-hmm. I think it was to fit my age. The story was to fit my age almost. It's almost as if whatever it is giving you the story to fit. So getting back to the story, I would have these sort of flying dreams where I would feel that this was coming somehow. You know, whether I was asleep when I felt it was coming or whether I was woke up, I always felt I was woken up. And there was like this feeling that whatever it was coming, and I knew it was coming. And this is very difficult to describe, but it was a feeling that I knew it had happened before and it was happening again. But between the last time it happened and the time it was currently happening, all knowledge of that had gone. So that's the only way I can describe it. You forget all about it until it happens again. But when it happens again, you recognise, oh, no, here we are. Oh, no, not again. You get that, oh, no, it's like a sense of dread. Here we go. And you know that there's nothing that's going to stop it. It's just going to happen. So this would be like, I would feel I was flying, and I would fly from my bedroom. So as I say, I'm sort of the flying carpet thing. I was about 5 or 6, and I'd fly along the landing. I don't know if that's a familiar term for you. It's just like, you know, the first floor between all the rooms. And then you come to the top of the stairs, and I would go down the stairs at some speed, you know. And as I got to the bottom of the stairs, there was a solid wall where the, well, in later years, the telephone would be mounted, but at that time, I don't think we would have had one. And I always felt as I got closer to that wall, which was an outside wall, I always felt I was going to hit the wall. But every time I managed to sort of bank, as if I was flying, it was a sort of bank off to the right, and then there would be a sudden turn to the left. And I would go through, literally go through a window. And when I say window, it was like the side light of the front door, which had little square glass bullions in a wood honeycomb type framework, you know. Mm-hmm. But I would go straight through it. And as I say, there was always a bit of a fear, oh, this is going to hurt. I'm going to hit this wall. And I'm, oh, I'm going to, you know. But it never did. It was always just like a tingle. It was like a almost like a cold tiggly sort of feeling, you know. So then I would be outside. And from it, as I got outside, it would be cold. Next thing I would remember would be sort of flying upwards. I always felt there was something with me as well, but I could never see anything. But I always felt there was something with me, and it was like a sort of kindly sort of presence, you know. And the next thing I would remember, because this is all just images that were there, that it wasn't like a non-stop film, you know. You couldn't just put it on a, make a film of it and show it all. It was just in images stuck with me.
Right.
So I would fly down our road, which was a very long road, of just like it was half what we call council estate, but it's really out in the countryside, like local authority, but really nice street. And then half the old-fashioned private houses, older, sort of 1900s style, right down to the end. And at the end, there was a cul-de-sac with probably 10 or more 1930s houses. And at the end of those houses, there was a little cut-through footpath which took you over a railway line. So anyway, I'm on what looks like a flying carpet, and I'm surrounded by children. And of course, I was a child myself. And they were various ages. You know, everything from, I suppose, 2 or 3 up to probably 8, 9, 10 maximum, you know. And they were sort of sitting together. And I can actually visualise that some of them were wearing pyjamas, like the old-fashioned stripy pyjamas with a cord, you know. And I think I would have had those on as well. And I can sort of visualise some of these children were crying. And but I was sort of, I must have been towards the back because I could sort of see most of them. And it was dark, and we were probably 20 or 25 feet above the rooftops. And it was cold. But I could see, this, and as I say, this was it wasn't just like it was a dream. This happened regularly. And I could see like tassels. It was like a rug, like a Persian rug. I think that's what I call them. And there were like tassels on it. And these tassels on the side of the rug were actually like billowing into the cold air as it was moving. Now, this is where, if I go back to what I started with, where I said I'm always a bit reluctant to talk about this one. I don't mind admitting to anybody that I've seen a ghost, because I know I've seen them. I know they're real. I think right. When we've seen them, we know. And we don't. And people like myself, we don't care what if people laugh, because they've clearly not seen them. We have. We know what we're talking about. but when it comes to this sort of thing, there is I've noticed with some people that they just automatically jump to that. Oh, you were abducted, you know. And I'm not comfortable with that at all, because I feel that it's deeper than that. I feel it's more to do with our consciousness, our psyche, whatever. I feel there's a bigger picture. You know, I can't really buy into that sort of whole abduction thing. I'm sorry to anyone who feels it's happened. Maybe it has. I don't know. I can only speak for myself. So, yeah. So, anyway, I was on this flying carpet, if you like. And I was looking down on the houses, and I could see in the back gardens of these houses that I would never especially as a six-year-old boy, I would never have seen the back gardens because I didn't know anyone on that side of the road.
Right.
But I could see everything in the back garden because it was like a moonlit night. And it was fascinating. I mean, I could see sheds and chicken runs and cats and you name it. I could see it all. But as we got to this cul-de-sac at the end, we must have sort of banked. I think if I remember rightly, starboard, I think, is left. I probably got that wrong. Starboard, I never remember. But as we went...
Yeah, I don't know which or which.
Yeah, but whichever. I can sort of remember going round and sort of looking into those gardens. And there was a climbing frame, like a child's climbing frame, with like made of the aluminium in a sort of tubular steel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a big one. And it was at the bottom of the garden. But at that time, I didn't know anyone who lived in that road. Very small cul-de-sac. I didn't know anyone in that road. And I'd certainly never been in any of those gardens. Now, if I'd have cut through that little cul-de-sac, there was a footpath, as I mentioned, and there's a footbridge over the railway line, which is the main railway line from sort of near London, we'll say, it's Reading, down to Gatwick Airport, which most people would have heard of. If I stood on that bridge, and I have tried this as a grown-up, as a six-foot-plus person, you cannot see in those gardens. You just can't. You can see trees in the gardens, but you can't see what they've got in their gardens, because I actually went back to try it. But I could actually see how the garden was laid out, and I could see this climbing frame in the bottom. Anyway, cut a long story short. Sometime after that, a lad moved into the area and he joined our class at school. The school was very close by. And we got friendly in the playground, and he basically, because I lived in the same village, he invited me round for tea, which his mother said he could. So long story. I went round there for the following day, and I didn't even know where he lived, but I sort of just followed him home. And he, it turned out, lived in that cul-de-sac. And as we walked into the cul-de-sac, I thought, oh, that's interesting. This is where I was looking in the gardens, you know. And he went to the same house. So as I walked up the drive, I can still remember it now. I still remember thinking, oh, this is great. This is where the climbing frame is. You know, but I couldn't tell him, obviously. So anyway, we went in and, we had tea. Beans on toast, I guess, for some reason, I always remember. And he had two older brothers. And after we'd eaten, we all went out and, I think it's summer evening probably, we all went out to have a kick around with a football. But I was impatient to get down the garden, down the end, because I knew that's where it was. So I went running off. I couldn't be bothered with kicking the ball about. I just wanted to get climbing. And I ran down the garden and probably said, oh, I'm going to go and play on your climbing frame, you know. Anyway, they all ran after me, and they sort of, I can remember being sort of elbowed out of the way by the bigger lads. And there was like a little cut through at the end where there's a hedge with a little, space for one person to get through. And there was like a mass sort of, where the sort of four of us sort of converged on the hole and clambered through. And there it was. And really all I can remember after that was one of these lads, I think it was one of the older brothers, was hanging on the crossbar of this climbing frame, but upside down, so it's like his knee was over the top of the bar,
right,
sort of staring at me, and I can still see his face, and he's sort of saying, how did you know we had a climbing frame? And it was like it had obviously been going through his mind. He's never been here before. How does he know? So obviously I couldn't tell him. I mean, even at that age, you don't talk about that sort of stuff. So I think I said something stupid like, oh, everybody's got them these days, you know, which was
right.
Total rubbish. I certainly never had one. That was a climbing frame thing.
And what's interesting there is, regardless of how you got the information, yeah, you had information that you really shouldn't have been able to have.
Yes. Yeah.
But whether it was an out-of-body experience, whether it was a dream where you picked up this information, I mean, regardless of the format, what's interesting about it is you could verify something in it that you shouldn't have been able to know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is. It puzzles me. All of these things puzzle me. I mean, I don't know the answers, as I say. I don't know. I'm familiar with all of this stuff because I've had a lifetime of it, and I listen to other people. It's always fascinated me. But I'm no closer. The more I know, the less I know, really.
Right, right. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Mark Wyatt.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wherediddtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wherediddtheroadgo.com.
And we're talking tonight with Mark Wyatt and his new book, Wyatt's Weird World. This is your first book, right?
It is, yes.
All right. And if I'm not mistaken, this is only your second interview.
It is, yes, yes. So I was on Jim Harold's show. Yeah, the other
All right. So, yeah. So this is all new for you.
It is, yes. I had to have some Dutch courage, actually, as you probably noticed earlier, yeah. Dutch courage being, that's a drink.
Ah, right.
Oh, have you not heard of that one?
No, I haven't.
No, we call it Dutch courage. It's like you have a pint and it helps you speak more fluidly. But if you have too many, obviously it doesn't help.
Right. You may think it helps at the time,
yes.
But when you listen back.
Yeah.
Tell us about the strange glowing men.
Yeah, that's I never actually saw them myself. That was just, well, how can I explain it? That was probably a couple of 2 to 3 years after the business with the flying carpet. I should actually just say, but I mentioned that flying carpet again before I get into that. I was an avid reader when I've always been a big reader, and I used to read and have read to me stories when I was younger. And one of the stories would have been Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, which would have given me the flying carpet scene.
Yeah, so maybe it coloured whatever experience you were having.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I just thought I'd mention that. I mean, the glowing men, probably 3 or 4 years later, so we're talking sort of late 60s, I suppose, late 60s, early 70s, we lived in this... trying to describe it like it was a semi-detached house, so it's like two houses stuck together with a passageway on the ground floor where you should walk through and go to your back gardens or backyards, I think you call them, don't you? And on the end of these two houses there were two bungalows, and it was a single street, a very long street, as I mentioned earlier. But it was right out in the countryside, absolutely beautiful countryside. There was about 4 miles of open countryside, fantastic countryside behind our house. Totally, totally rural. And our next door neighbour was on one side was an elderly couple, Mrs. Goat, a lovely lady. And she would quite frequently come round and say to my parents, usually my parents, she would say, "Did you see the strange glowing men in the garden last night?" And they used to say, well, what glowing men, you know, used to think. They didn't understand that question. So she would explain that her bedroom on the first floor was next door to their bedroom, you know, only a few feet away as the houses were joined. Mm-hmm. And it was looking out on countryside, so there's like big oak trees and there's fields and woods. But she used to see these men coming up our garden path. And they would come up from the river at the bottom of the garden. And they would, she said they would come up in a group. And she said it was as if they were, they looked as if they were lost. And they would all be sort of huddling together and talking. And they would dress strangely. But she was sort of trying to describe how they looked. But she said they were, had a, like a sort of glow to them, which obviously has connections to the fella that my father saw on a bicycle.
Right.
Same sort of thing. I mean, that they were sort of inwardly glowing. But she would see them coming up the path, and she would be standing in her room, sort of peering out the curtains, watching this. And they would get to the very top of the garden, sort of more or less directly underneath her. And she said she felt as if they were going into the passageway, which went the length front to back of the houses. So she would obviously assume that they were going to go out in the front. So she would rush through to the front of the house and open the curtains to see where they were going. But they never appeared on the other side of the house. And this had happened quite a few times. So she would then go back to the back window, and they hadn't gone back. And of course, it had happened quite a few times, and she would come around and talk about this. My father, as I say, he had seen something, you know, many years earlier than that. So he was quite open-minded, and, you know, he wouldn't have laughed at it.
Right.
It wasn't really taken that seriously. Nobody really took it that seriously. It was just like, we thought she's a little bit eccentric. And at that time, I was not really, I mean, as a kid, I wasn't that interested until I was probably 11 or so. I mean, I had my dad's story, but I didn't really get deep into it until I was a bit older. So it was just one of those things that she would occasionally come around and ask us, had we seen them? And, well, a couple of things here. My granddad, as it, this was, so I suppose, 75, 76, something like that. He'd had a stroke, and his character had sort of changed, and he'd become a sort of a weaker person, I suppose. And he used to sit, he lived with us while he was recovering, and he used to sit in our back room overlooking this garden, you know, daylight again.
Right.
And he would occasionally say, and it was quite, well, quite frequent really, he would suddenly do a double take, where he would look out the window and you'd see him look, and then he'd look back, and then he'd look back very quickly as if he'd seen something. And then he would say to whoever was in the room, "What are those strange men doing in the garden?" And of course we would look and we would never see anything. And, you know, we would sort of tease him a little bit probably and say, "Well, there's no one out there." And he would describe the same men as the old lady next door had seen at night time. So there was obviously something going on there. But what it was, I don't know. But there was a bit of a red herring that came up with this, because I'd heard a story from my mother years later. But I'll try and keep it short. She met an old man on the bus who got her talking. This was when she was, well, this would have been the 80s. And he said, "Oh, where'd you live?" She told him. He said, "I remember it when it was all fields." And he said there was an American bomber went down in that field during the war. And my mum told me this story. But the problem was, it was a short bus ride. She got the barest of information out of him. But then she had to get off the bus before she got enough information. But she did tell me about it. And I started researching it, and I did a lot of research on this a couple of months ago. And, you know, to be honest with you, I was hoping I would find, you know, it sounds awful, but I was hoping I would find there had been one, because it would have possibly explained these glowing men.
Yeah.
But as it turned out, I did a lot of research on this, I found old maps that showed where all the crashed sort of German planes were, the Americans, the British, you name it, where they'd crashed. And there were three different crashes, including the old V1 doodlebugs for flying bombs. And there were three different crashes during those war years, sort of 41, 45-ish, I suppose. And not one of them was actually in that field that he'd described to my mother. Not one of them was close enough to really explain why those blokes would have been walking up our garden. So I'd have to say, as a, you know, you've got to cross that one out and say, well, it couldn't have been really. But the only thing it could have been, we had, there's a very old mill. Shelford Mill is, I suppose, if you walked left at the end of our garden, it would have been half an hour, 20-minute walk maybe, to the mill. So people would have worked at the mill, making flour or whatever they did. And then on the other direction was the gunpowder works, which was in a neighbouring village because we'd moved from there. So if you followed that river, basically, one way was a mill, the other way was the gunpowder works. Now, the gunpowder workers did dress similar, in a similar way to the way that she described the men. And also similar to the way that my father described the guy on the bike. This all of these things happened within a couple of miles, maybe, I suppose. So there's, I would say there's a link there somewhere.
Okay. And it also could just be something where there was some weird energy and somehow this face of these things got put on it as well.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I know there is a tendency for us to just, it's like the, you know, I know people who automatically assume that, you know, if a spirit comes through a seance, or it's Auntie Flo or whatever, you know, and she's, because they say they're Auntie Flo, whereas I feel that it's like, it's more, it's an energy that's masquerading as Auntie Flo, if you like.
Right.
So it's, it could be, maybe it is, but I just feel that it's more likely to be, again, it's finding the words to describe it, but I think you're right, it's some sort of energy. Or is it something to do with timelines? Maybe earlier times, what we perceive as earlier times, are still happening.
Right.
So, I mean, I can't get my head around that, but that would explain a lot of, that would explain ghosts. And in some cases, I don't know. I think the jury's out on that one.
Right. I mean, things aren't always what they seem, basically.
Yes. Yeah.
Now you had this incident where you heard a screaming girl.
Oh yeah. Yes. That was, I mean, I think, you know, some people have got their sensitivity, if you like, in maybe some people see more ghosts and some people hear more. And I think mine's more hearing. I think, is it audio? What's the word? I've lost it now.
Oral.
Yeah, I think mine's more oral. And you often find that people who are, I mean, you're musical, I believe. You play in a band, don't you? I think people who are musical...
I'm not in a band, but I deal with musicians.
You quite often find musicians are very sensitive to sounds. And if they're going to see, if they're going to experience ghostly activity, you know, it's more likely to be something they hear, possibly. And I think that's the case with me. I was woken up in the early hours of the morning. This was in a different place, totally different place, sort of 10 miles away. You know, a quiet street. I was married by then. I was in my late 20s. And in the early hours of the morning, I was woken up by a terrible screaming. I mean, it was as if somebody was being, it was a woman, girl, and it was as if they were really suffering and screaming for their life. That's how bad it sounded. And my wife, who was in the same room, obviously, she couldn't hear a thing. And I was looking out the window, couldn't see. There were no lights coming on in people's houses or curtains being twitched, you know, so, which I found a bit odd because this screaming was really intense and loud. And I would have thought it would have woken up lots more people. And I was sort of in two minds as to whether to, it was a cold night and I was in two minds as to whether to go out and actually have a look, just to put my mind at ease to, you know, if somebody was being attacked. And it gradually, the sound of the screaming gradually got less and less. It sort of got a bit sort of muffled and distant. And I sort of convinced myself, you know, like you do in the early hours when you're something, you know, it's a bit like when you have these experiences and then you think, oh, that was interesting. And you just go back to bed, go out to sleep.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing. You don't sit up the rest of the night worrying about it. I never have done. But anyway, I just got talked myself into, oh, it's not a problem, it'll be okay. But I felt very guilty for a while because I thought, oh, you know, I had visions of the police arriving in the morning and setting up incident rooms on the street and questioning everybody, you know, did you hear the screaming girl? Which is where, did you read this? You read the story. Yes. I mean, obviously all that dialogue was just my imagination, you know, what might have happened.
Right.
But I did actually ask the neighbours, that's all true. And I asked all the neighbours, did you hear it? And none of them had. And so as the days and weeks went by, there was no story in local paper about anyone being attacked in the neighbourhood at all. You know, no people had gone missing. So I sort of put it behind me. And then 2 or 3 years later, we'd moved about 300 miles to the north, to a place near Newcastle. And Newcastle, I should say, for the Geordies. And my mother-in-law used to send us up the local newspaper from where we had lived in Woking, and just to sort of keep us in touch with the sort of football scores and this sort of thing. And the front page, as soon as I saw this front page, it said double death blow. I think it was double death blow to horse or family. And what had happened was our next door neighbours on the left of where we were, and we had some connection, you know, they were nice neighbours. There was a mum and a dad and a daughter who was an art student. The daughter would have been about 18 or 19. But what had happened was the daughter had actually been murdered by her boyfriend in the upstairs room, which would have been, you know, right alongside our room. And her boyfriend was a bit of a nut job. He used to carry knives around, evidently. I never knew him, but he was found in town, wandering around, covered in blood, and sort of in a bit of a state of shock, you know. But what happened, he had a big row. She tried to drop him, evidently, so give him the elbow. He got upset, stabbed her. And then as he ran down the stairs from the third floor box room, the mother had run up. From, you know, hearing the commotion, she'd gone up to see what was going on, and unfortunately she got attacked as well. I think it was just his fright as he was running out from the scene, you know, just panics and attacked her. And as I say, he was picked up later. But this, when I saw this, it crossed my mind that maybe there'd been some sort of ripple in time or something. I don't know. Well, I got a glimpse, premonition, if you like, or something that was going to happen, because obviously that poor girl would have been screaming, and the mother would have been screaming. So again, it comes back to the nature of time. I mean, in timelines, you know, I mean, it's too big for my little brain to wrap itself around, but
certainly an interesting possibility.
Yeah, I mean, the other more mundane one is that. And I have experienced this many times, but there's a lot of foxes in the area, and foxes do scream, especially when they're mating. And just recently, I mean, a couple of months ago, I was staying in that same village, and a fox did wake me up in the early hours, and it was screaming. But I would say that fox didn't sound anything like the woman, you know, what I heard that night, sort of 10, 15, 20 years earlier.
Not only that, but you woke your wife up and she couldn't hear it.
Yes,
if it was
a
fox, she would have heard the fox screaming.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I never really thought of that, actually. Yeah, you're right. So,
and there's a lot of things you talk about in this book, where you see something and other people don't see it, which is, it kind of goes to that sensitivity type of thing.
Yes.
You know, these things are responding to just you.
Yeah, I mean, we probably haven't got time to tell the story, but there's a classic one, actually. We still have these friends who used to be English heritage custodians, so which basically means they looked, they're employed by the state to work to look after old national monuments, castles, mm-hmm. Stately homes, that sort of thing. And at one point, they were at a castle, a 12th century castle in the northeast. And I lived up there for 10 years. And they were at the bottom of the street, you know. So we spent a lot of time in and out of Prudhoe Castle. That's like Prud, it's spelled Prudhoe, which is like Norman for Proud Heights. It's on the side of the valley. And anyway, we used to have access to places in that castle that nobody else did, because obviously he worked there and he lived in. But the children of that family used to regularly see apparitions. I mean, they actually got used to it. They'd see a guy walk through the wall and he was dressed funny, you know.
Yeah.
And they thought nothing of it. But the parents didn't actually see anything, as far as I know. They did experience audio things again, or oral things. But I actually saw a character that, I mean, I don't know if you've got as far as reading that, but Henry VIII. I'm not saying it was Henry VIII, because what are the odds on that? But he was dressed in the way that you see pictures of King Henry VIII in your school history books, you know. And he was a big man, whoever this guy was. But cut a long story short, we were around there for dinner, sort of the early evening, and I'd been asked to go and get some leaflets or something for my friend who was the custodian. But I had to, because they'd locked up for the night at sort of 3 or 4 hours earlier, I had to go a slightly different way, because it was all for fire safety. You had to lock certain doors. So I had to go the long way round, and I went along a huge corridor. I wasn't familiar with this particular piece I was in, but I was just following the instructions I've been given. And I got to the stairway, dropped down the stairway, and as I was, I suppose, 8-10 feet off the ground on the stairs, I was still going down, I sort of stopped in my tracks, because I heard somebody walk towards me. And it was like heavy footsteps, you know, it was sizable, and it was a sizable man, much bigger than me. And as he walked towards me, he was dressed like King Henry VIII. So, and I can honestly say he looked like King Henry VIII. And I just naturally assumed that, because they have these what we call reenactors who reenact historic scenes for the punters, you know, when it's open to the public. So I just assumed he was one of these reenactors, but I couldn't figure out why he was there in the evening, you know, because as far as I was aware, we were the only people on, you know, his family and my family, that was it. So anyway, I saw this character. As he got closer to me, he looked up to me, and I just stood there and watched him, and I just sort of said hi or something, you know, which looking back, I don't suppose they would know what hi was in those days, but you know, it's a strange thing. But he looked at me, he actually looked directly at me, and he did have whoever it was, he had a full-on face. There was no, you know, there was no black void or holes for eyes and none of that. He's just a normal man. And he basically ignored me. He just stared right through me, you know. And then he carried on to the right and went off through a doorway. And I just thought, well, that was a bit odd. So I went and got the leaflets that I had to get, and I went back. And then, to cut a long story short, I didn't mention it straight away, but as I was helping him do these leaflets, I just kept questioning him, like, did you have any reenactors in today to do any, when he said, well, no. And I said, well, have you got any in tomorrow? No. And he was like, well, why do you keep asking me these questions, you know? And I said, well, I've just seen a guy downstairs. And his automatic response, you know, he's a very sort of materialistic sort of guy, you know, was, oh dear, we've got somebody in the castle who shouldn't be here. And obviously sure. it's his job to keep the place safe and secure. So then his wife came through, and it was a funny moment. She came through, and he's saying to her, Mark says he's just seen, because I hadn't described what he looked like at that point. So Mark says he's just seen a guy downstairs. So she said, what did he look like? And you can imagine, there was like, I sort of took a deep breath and said, King Henry VIII. And it was like, almost like a situation comedy, really. And then she sort of broke into this silly little ditty, you know, I'm Henry VIII, I am, I don't know, the old musical thing.
Uh-huh.
So, but then we actually went downstairs, Howard and myself went downstairs, and we went looking for this fella. Of course, we never found him. But he was as solid as you or me. And again, he was doing what I call a walk-by. It was, you know, it's almost as if they're aware of you and they want to show themselves. But anyway, I did a little bit of research when I was writing this. I didn't do this at the time, to see whether the actual Henry VIII would have gone to that castle. And there's nothing that I could find to say that he had. But looking at the history of it, the family who run the castle, they were a very, very powerful Norman family, that because the castle was built by the Normans. And there was like a dynasty of, they were called the Percys. They're quite a famous family, the Percy family. And one of the Percys was going, so again, it's modern phraseology. He was going out with or linked up with Anne Boleyn.
Ah.
Now, there's the link, isn't it, Anne Boleyn? Because he was going out with or married to, I can't remember the exact details, Anne Boleyn, but King Henry VIII wanted, I think they called it betrothed or something, some old worldly language. He wanted her for himself, basically, which,
yeah.
And of course he did. He did get her. So I feel that there's a possibility that he would have gone up there, probably with his heavies, because, I mean, you know, they weren't pleasant people, these royal families of the past. So I feel he would have gone up there and he would have taken his heavies up there with him and probably would have made him an offer he couldn't refuse, you know. I don't know, that's just my spin on it. But so I think it's a possibility he had been there. But as somebody said to me when they read it, it probably just looked like him. You know, it would have been the fashion to dress like that.
True.
So I just probably just saw somebody of that era. But it wasn't a reenactor anyway, because there weren't any there and nobody was staying overnight. So, and it wasn't at all frightening either. I mean, you know, this book, some people have said to me, well, you know, it's not very frightening. Well, it's not meant to be frightening. It's just, they're genuine stories. I can't sort of make them frightening if they're not. It's just how they happened. You know,
A lot of your ghost stories are sort of like that, where you don't even realize you're seeing a ghost until afterwards.
That's right, yeah.
And you're like, wait, where did they go? Or someone's like, no, there's no one there.
Yeah. I mean, the Phantom Biker is the one that I actually had broad daylight. And I was just driving along in Northumberland. I was repping as a builder's merchant rep. It was a beautiful day, and I was taking a shortcut across from one village to another, and you couldn't see another car for, you know, miles. You could see a long way in all directions. And suddenly felt there was something. I don't know whether I got the feeling first, but I looked in the mirror and there was a guy unnaturally close behind me on a motorbike. And he was just a sort of crazy sort of stare, but he had sort of goggles on, and he had like a silk scarf, and it was blowing in the wind, but it looked strange. It looked like it was starched. And yeah, closest I can think could be like something like Biggles, you know, the character Biggles, you know, Captain W. Lee John's books. Do you remember the artwork for them? Something, a character that looked a little bit like him, or possibly Dick Dastardly. I don't know if you've seen Dick Dastardly. Something like that. But he was on a bike. I think he had like a long overcoat type thing on, or what I could see of it, and like gauntlet gloves. And I would say that it was like 1920s, 30s, something like that, probably. But when I first saw him, I just thought, I thought it was some guy who was into old motorbikes, who liked dressing the part and went out for a spin. You know, that's what you would think. And he was unnaturally close, and I don't like any vehicle too close behind me. So I was looking for somewhere to pull over so I could let him go by. And there were little passing places, but it was like a narrow one-way track. You know, you had to just right. let each other by. And so I was looking for the next one. And by the time I found it, I sort of pulled in. And as I pulled in, I looked to my side because I wanted, because I actually love old motorbikes, and I wanted to see him as he went by, but he didn't go by. And I sort of got out of the car and had a look. I thought, well, where could he have gone? There was nowhere, because I would have seen him go by. And again, I think it's they pick their moments and whatever they are.
And I've actually heard other people who have had stories like that with phantom bikers and phantom cars behind them, and then yes. they pull over and there's nothing there.
Well, I believe Steve Stockton, because I read one in his book. And
And it
was quite similar, actually. So maybe that's, I suppose that really comes out of sort of road ghosts, doesn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, your website is what? Wyattsweirdworld.com?
No, it's actually, it's oh dear, my memory's gone all to pieces now. It's so late. it's a dark, dark night. I had to think about that. I've only just changed it, actually, because I used to do a more general website, and then the sort of paranormal stuff started to sort of take over. So I changed it to It's a Dark, Dark Night. Which comes from my son is a musician, and he wrote a song called It's a Dark, Dark Night, which is sort of similar to like the Addams Family type sort of vibe. You know, it's like a jolly little bass line, very mm-hmm. quite simple but very catchy. And the song was the only lyrics I know of it was It's a Dark, Dark Night, you know, and I just thought that's fantastic. I fancy getting a podcast one day. I'm going to do it. I'd love to use that. So that's where the name comes from. Because I just thought It's a Dark, Dark Night fitting in with paranormal content. But it's going to be, it's not just about me. It's going to be about, you know, hopefully this book's got all my stuff out of the way. And from now on, I'm writing a book about Cornwall, about the paranormal side of Cornwall. And I've been interviewing various people on that. And but the book is more... sorry, the website is going to be covering other people's stuff as well. So if I see something paranormal-based, which I really find interesting, with their permission, I'll put it on my site, you know, and obviously it's sort of symbiotic relationship. They hopefully their word will be spread as well.
Nice.
So, you know, we can all help each other sort of thing. So, and I have found some wonderful stuff already. I mean, some 1950s. Recordings of people in sort of, I think it's most, sort of Norfolk or somewhere in England, but sort of north of London, talking about Civil War ghosts, you know, English Civil War ghosts, and fantastic stories about people seeing, you know, horsemen sort of coming towards them, and they've got all the gear on, and then they just sort of fade into nothing. And this was from the 1950s, the original recording. So I've stuck that on my site because it's just fantastic. And just up the road from where I'm sitting now, which is in Cornwall, we had an English Civil War battle, the Battle of Stamford Hill, 1640-something, 42, around there somewhere. And there was quite a big battle between the Royalists and the Parliamentarians. And it's only, you know, a mile or so up the road. So, and the anniversary is next month. So with a colleague, I'm going up there to try and get some EVPs.
Nice.
Although I suspect it might be a bit busy because we have this organisation called the Sealed Knot in England, which they all dress up as cavaliers and parliamentarians and... They sit in our old pubs, and they do the reenacting thing where they.
Oh.
In fact, I actually inadvertently offended, not deliberately, obviously, a few years ago. I went up to this pub, and they were all in there, all dressed up, massive. They looked fantastic. All the cavaliers. They all got very long hair, and they've got the you know, the free clothes and everything. And then there were the roundhead types as well. They were in another bar. They weren't talking to each other. That's how serious they take this. And, you know, and they have little grudges. It's weird. And with a friend, we went and sat down with some of these people at a table in this really old pub called the Tree, which is where some of the people who actually were fighting in on that day, including a giant, strangely enough, Anthony Payne, his name was, they used to drink in that pub. So, you know, 400 years ago. We sat in there and we thought, oh, we go and sit with them because they'll be very entertaining and they can tell us all the history and so on. But right. they didn't like us being there because we were wearing modern clothes.
Oh.
They were very, very touchy. And in the end, we just got up and we realised that we were, you know, square pegs in round valves or whatever, you know. We better get out, you know. So, yeah, they take it very, very seriously. So what I'm thinking is I've got to be a bit careful about what I do see up there because they might just be those lads.
yeah.
So
all right, well, thanks for spending some time with us and talking to us about your book and your experiences.
Okay.
The book is enjoyable. It's not a heavy read by any means. But it's a fun read.
Yes, I've put some a bit interesting of stuff. Yeah, my humor is quite dark, as you probably noticed, and yeah, which comes in with it's a dark night again. It's partly dark paranormal and partly dark humor.
Yes.
And I tried. It's an unusual mixture, isn't it? But
not necessarily. I like that mixture.
Mm.
And the book is called Wyatt's Weird World.
Yeah, the book's Wyatt's Weird World. And as I say, I'm working on the next one's going to be about other people's experiences now I've got that out of the way. And I'm hoping that'll be out, well, within the year.
Awesome. So, well, thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Sir. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope I didn't rattle on too much.
All right, that was Mark Wyatt, and I hope you enjoyed that. And we're going to take you out tonight with some nightmares from Psyche Corporation.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. The day I was born, you promised me hellfire. You were so sure I grew up waiting for demons to find me. I grew up hungry for ghosts to define me. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Suffering, offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn. I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Bind me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Ma chère éclate à cause des ailes. En grand secteur de primavera. Yeah.